Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Hallmarkies podcast. I'm so excited today to bring you a very special interview. This is a bonus interview. It's one of our off-network interviews that we're doing with the director of the upcoming movie, The Other Side of Heaven 2. Mitch Davis is here, and I'm really excited to get a chance to talk to you. Thanks so much for coming on the podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm glad to be an honorary Hallmarkie.
Yes, this is so exciting. So what we like to do with our podcasts and our interviews is to give our guests a chance, introduce yourself and tell us what inspired you to become a director.
Wow. Well, my name is Mitch Davis. I'm the oldest of seven kids, raised in Southern California. I grew up wanting to be a sports writer for my local newspaper, and then had a chance to be a missionary in South America. Back in 1977, I was in Argentina, and I had sort of a kind of, I guess you'd call it a spiritual experience one day, where I just felt really strongly impressed that someday I needed to make a movie about the missionary experience. Because for me, that experience was just really transformative. It took this kind of sheltered, selfish kid from an upper middle class lifestyle in California to places of great poverty and in some cases tragedy and difficulty, and yet I just learned to love these people so much, and they in turn loved me back. And I just thought, wow, someday you got to tell that story to the planet. And so now I've made not one, but two movies about it. First of which was a Disney distributed hit film back in the year 2000 that starred none other than Anne Hathaway. So I love all stories, but I think I love stories of fishes out of water, missionaries in a new strange land, crossing barriers and cultures and learning to love like we can only really. It's just no better thing to do than to love a stranger and have that stranger become your part of your family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I can certainly relate to that. I served my own mission in Indiana for almost 2 years ago. I know the feeling.
Yeah. It's real. Yeah. So you asked me how I became a director. The truth is I wanted to be a sports writer. All of a sudden I had this strong feeling that I was supposed to be a filmmaker. And I learned a few things really quickly. Number one, I learned that when you're a screenwriter, you have no control over what happens to your words on the page after you give them to a director and a producer. They can do whatever they want. And so I thought, well, that I can't have that. I got to become a director so I can direct the words I've written in my script. And then I quickly discovered that nobody wanted to hire me. So then I thought, well, I got to become a producer so I can hire myself to direct the words that I wrote. It all started with just wanting to write a few words that would become a movie. And I've ended up, wearing a lot of hats as a result.
Wow. So did you grow up, loving film, watching movies, or were you more into sports, or how did that happen?
I think that I don't think I was really an unusually connected film buff. I saw a few movies. I went to the drive-in with my folks on, once a week, and I mean, I saw movies, but I was not a pop culture maven. That kind of changed. It really changed when I had that spiritual experience, because I just suddenly realized, wow, this is a megaphone. You can make a beautiful movie that will live a life and go all over the world and do good and lift people's spirits. How cool would that be? And as opposed to writing writing an article for your local newspaper about a football game that everybody forgets the next day. So
So I
kind of became mission driven about making movies, and it kind of started, you know, it started, I actually saw, somehow I missed it my entire life. I never saw the movie It's a Wonderful Life until my freshman year in college. I took a film appreciation class.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the period of my life. And I was just kind of trying to figure out what my life is going to be about. And I saw that movie about this man who led a small life and yet changed an entire community of people. And it really affected me. It wasn't like I'd seen a movie. It was like I'd received a letter from God. I mean, that's just, wow. I spent like 3 days walking around my college campus, picking up litter and opening doors for people because I just wanted to be a better person. And after that experience, you know, that contributed to my passion. And it really is a passion now to make a few movies that matter, because holy cow, you can go into a theater and, you know, be assaulted by images that are vile and dark and repulsive and frightening.
Uh-huh.
Or you can go into a theater and be uplifted and become overjoyed and encouraged. And I just really want to do the latter.
Yeah. So you were like Jimmy Stewart for a couple days there, running around, Merry Christmas, movie house.
No, I was. Listen, I'm going to make a true confession now, and this is going to be published to all the world now. Like after a rainstorm, you know how the earthworms come out and they're on the sidewalk and they get stuck.
Yeah.
I was walking around, you know, helping night crawlers get back to the grass. I mean, it was that bad.
That's hilarious.
Yeah.
I love it. You should make a movie about your experience being inspired to make a movie. I think that's really cool.
Yeah.
So you hadn't had any real, like, this just kind of, you know, it feels like this spiritual prompting kind of came out of nowhere in a way. Like, you were just
minding
your own business.
It really did. I mean, there's no question. I mean, I was thoroughly engrossed in the experience of sharing what I believed with people I had come to love. Yeah. I was thoroughly immersed in that. And then just really out of nowhere, this thing, hey, someday you're going to make a movie about this. And I was like, what? But it's changed. I mean, it's that singular experience has really directed my life ever since. Over 40 years, I've been really, really working hard to make good on that.
That's a great story. I love that. It's like a modern day Noah, you know, to our Nephi. I don't know why I'm building a boat. They told me to build a boat. I don't know why. I don't know why I'm making movies. That's what he said to do. So that's great.
The hard thing about being Noah or an independent filmmaker is that you drag your family along with you.
Yeah.
I mean, Noah didn't get on that boat alone and he didn't build it alone. And that has been a big part of my journey, has been that I had just a dear, beautiful wife who was willing to be supportive. Yeah. And I've had a family. I mean, we've made movies in Rarotonga, in New Zealand, in Israel, in Bulgaria. We've made, and now Fiji. We've made movies a lot of places, and it's never been easy.
Uh-huh.
But it's been a great experience.
That's great. Well, so how did you become involved in the first film originally? With this desire you had to make this missionary story, how did you end up getting involved in it?
So I, you know, a guy who doesn't know a dang thing about making movies and is not related to Clint Eastwood or Robert Redford, I had no way to figure, I just had no connectivity to Hollywood. So I figured out that film school was probably my best shot. And so I applied to a bunch of film schools throughout the U.S. And the only one I was accepted to was the number one film school in the world at the time. And I think it probably still is. It was a USC film school. And, you know, fresh on the heels of George Lucas and Ron Howard and just a long list of really accomplished filmmakers, I showed up and I didn't have a clue what I was doing, but I got in and I began to compete and learned a lot of great things, met a lot of great people. And at the end of the semester, there was an internship offered at Disney. There was a competition at the school, you know, submit your application to get an internship at Disney. And so I don't know, a couple hundred of us competed, and five of us got sent over to Disney, and they interviewed two of us, and they took me, and I was just so fortunate to get that gig. And I showed up my first day. I really had no idea what the internship was going to be. I just thought, well, I get to be on the Disney lot, and that's cool. So, you know, I would have shined shoes to be there. But I show up and I say, hey, my name is James. She said, oh yeah, you're the new intern. You should go into that room right there. There's a meeting and you're late. And so I walked into this room and there was Jeffrey Katzenberg and the top 10 in-house producers for the Disney company. And Katzenberg was like on the phone with Michael Eisner discussing whether or not we should buy a particular movie. And they kind of looked at me and just pointed, and I sat down and I realized that I had become part of what's called the creative group. It was a group of 10 in-house producers that decided what major motion pictures Disney was going to make at any given time. We developed them. We worked on the scripts with the writers. We took pitch meetings, and I was just in straight out of film school, which was just the most bizarre thing.
Yeah. And, wow.
Yeah. No, I got to work on, after about a month of being an intern, they hired me, made me full time. And I got to work on Rocketeer, and I got to work on Dead Poets Society and Pretty Woman. And,
oh my God.
And actually, Newsies was one of my, was a movie that the writers came and pitched it to me. And a guy named Donald DeLine, and we made the buy recommendation, and so I got to be a part of something really remarkable, really fast. And I figured, you know, it was all downhill from there. I had it all figured out, but it didn't turn out that way. It ended up being a longer journey, but that was a great start. Disney was a great start.
That's really cool. Yeah, if you were there for Newsies, you were, I mean, that was a cream kind of time. I mean, I know Newsies was a big flop, but that early 90s, you know, Disney Renaissance and everything, that was a great time to kind of be there. Everything kind of.
No, it was very dynamic. Jeffrey Katzenberg was and still is a force of nature. And, And I learned a lot just being around him and observing him. But yeah, but it spawned a lot of great hit movies, and a lot of great film producers and filmmakers came out of that era.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called Pi: People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcast, homecast.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Yeah. Yeah. That's really cool. Wow. I mean, I love a lot of those movies from that era. I mean, I love Newsies. I love Rocketeer. I love a lot of the live action films. And you know, people forget that there were quite a few films that were Disney films, but they were through Touchstone or some of the other studios that they work with. Even something like Arachnophobia, you never think of that as Disney, but it actually is.
Yeah. No, they were there. I mean, the model back then, they were doing 25 to 30 movies a year, you know, and Jeffrey's model was pump them out at a modest budget and we're going to spread our risk. So, you know, if we're going to, instead of making one $100 million movie, we're going to make four $25 million movies and then one out of those four will be a hit. And so it was an interesting time, and Hollywood has certainly changed a lot since then, but Jeffrey Katzenberg is still a major force, having a big impact. You know, went on to found DreamWorks
Interesting. So you're working on the production side of things. So did you just come across Elder Groberg's book, or were you just presented? How did that work that you ended up getting involved
It's a really, it's a really long story. And I don't want to bore you with all the details, but I went to film school to figure out how to become a filmmaker.
Yeah.
And then I worked at Disney, and then I worked at Columbia, and then I sold a script, and I got to direct my first movie, and it flopped, and I got stalled, and I actually took 5 years off of the movie business because I was kind of discouraged, and I had some church assignments that were very consuming, and I just decided to push the pause button on movie making. And then, I took a regular job. Life was good. We were making money, and serving in our church. And then I was informed that I was going to be released from my assignment. It was a 5-year assignment, and my release was coming up, and all of a sudden this little voice kind of came back in my mind. Hey, Mitch, remember that movie you were going to make about being a missionary? Remember that? Remember why you went to film school? Remember why you worked at Disney? And so I had a conversation with my wife, because she knew all about it. You know, she knew that we'd sold our house and moved to LA to go to film school. So she knew that there was a reason for all that. And I just said, honey, what about that thing? And I was about, how old was I? I was about 40 at the time. And she said, honey, I think if you don't do it now, you never will. Mm-hmm. I think we should just go for it, is what she said. And so, I quit my job. We put a second mortgage on the house, and I had not even discovered John Groberg's book, at that moment. I just knew that I was supposed to make a movie about what it meant to be a missionary. And so I sat down and started to write one, and I wrote one about my own mission to Argentina. And I thought that was going to be the one, and I showed it to some people, and they liked it okay, but they weren't jumping over the moon about it. And so I kind of scratched my head, like, wait a second, you quit your job, you mortgaged your house to make this movie, and you don't have a movie. And a friend of mine told me that there's this book he read about a guy's mission in Tonga in the 1950s, and he said, you should you should read this. And I'd actually heard from two others about the same book, and I'd ignored them all. But he would not take no for an answer. He grabbed his copy off of his shelf and just shoved it at me and said, just shut up and read this. And so I did. And honestly, I was only like 10 pages into the book. It's a 300-page book, but I was 10 pages into it. And I just knew with every fiber of my being, this is the movie. This is it. And so then I was glad I'd quit my job and mortgaged the house. And I set about acquiring the movie rights. I set about adapting the book into a script. I set about creating a limited liability company and raising the equivalent of $11 million in today's dollars. And I just went after it. And I've never been, well, I have been a few other times in a few other ways, but I was just so sure that the universe, God, wanted that movie done, that I just went after it. And wow. I couldn't be stopped. And that sounds arrogant, but what I mean is I just mean that I was possessed of a kind of faith that made it impossible for me to stop. I just kind of kept going and going and going. And I had actually written the script, two drafts of the script, and created a company and raised a couple million bucks before I even got the movie rights from the book, because it took like 6-8 months to negotiate for the movie rights. Anyway, so that became The Other Side of Heaven. That became the Disney hit with Anne Hathaway in it. And that became, you know, her first feature film role ever. And that movie has been all over the world for the last 20 years, just like Jimmy Stewart in walking the streets of his little town doing good. It's just been this good-natured, uplifting, friendly film that has lifted hearts and brightened minds. And I'm just so excited about that and grateful for it.
That's
and
great.
And I'm so that, yeah, which is why I'm so passionate about this sequel.
Yeah.
That I hope it'll be given the chance to do the same thing.
Very cool. Yeah, that's great. I admire you just going for it. You get that inspiration. You don't doubt. I mean, I'm sure you had your moments, but still you did it. That's impressive. Oh. That's impressive.
Well, you should admire my wife. That's who you should admire. And you should feel sorry for. No, it was, but you know that movie, you can still see The Other Side of Heaven. It's on Amazon Prime, and other video on demand sites. It's just a PG rated, thoughtful, sweet film that really, really belongs on the Hallmark Channel, but it's never been there. So if any executives from Hallmark are listening right now, I hope they will call me. And yeah, we'll make a deal.
There you go. Make that happen. Did you, I assume that you got to meet Elder Groberg probably many times, but
oh, yeah,
early on, yeah, how involved was he, or was he involved at all? Or what was that like sort of adapting his story?
Yeah. So when I contacted the publisher and said, hey, I want to make a movie out of this book, first of all, they were stunned. You know, the book was kind of a religious themed series of sermons about Elder Groberg's missionary service in Tonga in the 1950s, and there had never been a movie made on this general topic before ever. You know, missionary movies were not the bomb, especially faith-promoting missionary movies. So once they realized I was serious, they, you know, They said, well, yeah, we do hold the movie rights and we're willing to consider selling them to you. But Elder Groberg, who wrote this book, we really would like you to meet with him and have his personal approval before we proceed any further. If he doesn't feel good about this, then we won't do it. And so they arranged a meeting for me with him. And I didn't know him at all. He didn't know me at all. We had no friends or family in common. I just went to his office and told him I had this vision and I felt that his book was a part of it. And he was initially quite cautious and reluctant. But then as I sort of explained my passion and what I felt was my spiritual impulsion to do this, he got really excited. And he said, you know what? I feel really good about this. So, but here comes the hard part. Now you got to talk to my wife. And he said, Jean is a very private person and she does not like this idea at all. This is our family story and our love story. And, you know, you're going to have to really, would you be willing to come to my house and meet with my wife? And so I did. I met with John and Jean, and I met with them a few times before they finally said yes. And then they just really trusted me. It was a 300-page book that I adapted into a 100-page script. So you have to do a lot of compositing and, mm-hmm. and, reorganizing and shuffling. But they never saw the movie until its premiere and they never demanded to see it. They just really trusted me. And that was a beautiful experience. And I think that they were happy with the result and they felt that the movie did a lot of good. And so they were actually much more anxious for the sequel to be made than I was. I resisted making the sequel for a long time, but they always had a vision of it.
Very cool. Wow. That's great. So how did you end up casting Christopher as the lead in the film? How did that kind of come about?
Christopher Gorham, what a dear, good man. I tell you, we hired the former director of casting for Disney. Her name was Gretchen Rennell Court to cast this movie. And she worked for months. I mean, she was in New York and Chicago and LA seeing people. And I spent weeks and weeks watching her best gets. And she got so frustrated with me because I was looking for light. I was looking for somebody with a gentle spirit and light in their eyes. And she just couldn't quite figure out what I meant by that. But, you know, she brought in some great people. Paul Walker, Hayden Christensen, Shane West. There are a bunch of... And by the way, for the Anne Hathaway role, I auditioned like Amy Adams, and I auditioned a bunch of people.
Yeah.
But for the Chris Gorham role, for the Elder Groberg role, I just kept saying no until Chris walked into the room, and I just took one look at Chris, and he's just a sweet, dear, good man. He is Jimmy Stewart. He's a Jimmy Stewart of our day and almost really before he even auditioned or read the words, I knew he was the guy. So, and it turned out it was his first role, his first lead role in a film or a TV series. He'd always have been cast in supporting roles and he just nailed it. And, we were so grateful to get him back for the sequel.
Yeah. Yeah. So I've watched just about every, what would be determined as faith-based films that have come out in the last two decades. And uh-huh. It's a really tough genre, I think. Ooh.
It is.
It's very difficult to find that line between making a ministry tool and making a movie. And you forget that, I think sometimes with the best of intentions of teaching about a ministry thing that you believe in, that people believe in, they can lose their telling a story, and that they are also trying to, you know, entertain people. And something like War Room, for instance, was a ministry movie, not a movie. One thing I always admired about this one is that I feel like they did a really good job, The Other Side of Heaven did a really good job of telling a story and having the faith, obviously because he is a missionary, and because, you know, that is story first, ministry second. Is that something that you were conscious of, that you were trying to walk that line?
Boy, yeah, I sure was conscious of that, and have been with the sequel. And I'm glad you think we pulled it off. I mean, it's really, really hard.
Yeah.
Because if you look at the whole faith, not just the faith film movement, but the way the world views faith right now. I mean, faith is not a popular, it's a four-letter word. It's got five letters, but it's a four-letter word right now in popular culture. And people of faith are generally depicted as narrow-minded, xenophobic, you know, bigoted, unkind, ignorant people. And we're not.
Yeah. Well, and the ironic thing is, often I feel like it's themselves portraying themselves that way. They're the ones that are making the atheists all seem like horrible people that have no redeeming values. They're the ones making the Christian characters seem super judgmental and harsh. And, you know, it's like, it's an odd thing. Like, I can't think of I think it's Miracles from Heaven or something with Jennifer Garner. Mm-hmm. I think that was actually a decent movie. The Christian characters were so mean to her. How dare you say that this is a miracle? What are you know? And we're really cruel to her. And I was just kind of like, what are they trying to do here? Like, this is weird. And or something like In God's Not Dead, where the atheist character is just the worst human being to ever exist. You know, he's just an absolutely horrible person. And it makes it not interesting. But I think that there are some that that managed to find that balance, and I think it serves the ministry better when you can do that. I like Other Side of Heaven. I like The Best 2 Years. I like the one called All Saints from a couple years. I thought that one was really good at just telling a story about how they're building this farm, and it was messy, and the faith is messy, and it's not. I don't really like it when I sort of joke that it's like Jesus' magic in some of these movies.
Right.
I thought I Can Only Imagine was pretty solid and pretty well done.
I agree.
It can be done. And there's lots of incredible things that happened to Elder Groberg. But I feel like it was handled very gently.
I totally agree with everything you just said, but I wouldn't want any Christian filmmaker or faith filmmaker to feel like I'm throwing a stone at them, because I know how stinking hard it is to get a movie made. And we all make our movies for different reasons, and we all make mistakes when we do make them. And there are always things that we're in the editing room and we think, oh man, I wish I'd done that differently. But I was trained up at Disney to make fish out of water movies, to tell stories of put an ordinary person in an extraordinary situation, and you've got a movie. That's what Katzenberg used to always say. And so I agree, story first, because otherwise. The problem I have with a lot of faith films is they only have the capacity to preach to the choir because they're so harsh or strong or vitriolic or what, dogmatic, whatever, that the only people who are going to watch them are going to be people who already agree with them.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm like, no, let's find common ground. Let's be human. Let's laugh together. Let's cry together. And then let's consider some of the spiritual content woven throughout it. But if you hit people over the head with a sledgehammer and say, believe this, the only people who are going to do that are people who already do agree with you. And yeah. And so I'm grateful you feel that we pulled that off. I think in this second film, we've just done two screens of it. We did a screening at the Fuller Seminary in Pasadena on Thursday of last week, uh-huh, to a bunch of ministers and priests and clerics and the emeritus president of the seminary, Dr. Richard Mao, moderated a Q&A afterwards. And I loved what he said. He said, this movie is a feast for the eyes and a feast for the heart.
Oh.
And I think maybe one of the reasons that works in these Other Side of Heaven movies also is because we go someplace else. We don't set these movies are not set in Arizona in 2019. They're set in Tonga.
Right.
In the 1950s and the 1960s, and so you kind of get, you're able to take a little bit of the edge off, and Tongans are spiritual people, so you don't, and they're gentle, loving, unconditionally loving people, so you kind of just get a little bit of South Pacific breeze blowing through your spiritual films.
Very cool. Yeah. So the second one, is it based on Elder Groberg's second book, or is it kind of an amalgamation of things?
No, it's the same. So what happened? Elder Groberg served as a young man missionary, 19 to 21, between 54 and 57. He was, alone on these Tongan Islands as a young missionary. And that's when he fell in love with the Anne Hathaway character, Jean Groberg. Through the letters, went home and married her. So that's the end of the first missions. But then what happened is he was sent back only 9 years later with his now wife, Jean Groberg, and their five young daughters to be the mission president over the same mission that he'd been a part of. So as a 31-year-old man with a wife and five daughters, he goes back to Tonga to be the mission president, and has a similarly harrowing and inspiring and comical set of experiences, only this time his wife and daughters are in tow, so it's all kind of multiplied and magnified by their involvement in his second mission to Tonga.
Wow. So what was that like, kind of going back and getting Christopher back and just being back doing another Other Side of Heaven movie?
You know, it was, number one, it was the hardest thing I've ever done. Mm-hmm. And number two, I think it was the best thing I've ever done. And number three, it was the hardest thing I've ever done. Number four, it was the hardest. It was so hard. This movie was hard, but it was beautiful and rich. And getting Chris back and then getting a number of the actors from the first film back to come up from New Zealand, those things made it a really beautiful experience. But this movie... this movie, you have child actors, you have animal actors, you have a boat on the open ocean with stunts going on, and it was a big undertaking, and And we had adversity. We had two cyclones hit our movie. And I 2 days before I traveled to Fiji to start shooting the film, actually 3 days, I had a skiing accident and I blew out a shoulder. I dislocated it, broke it, and tore the rotator cuff. And I had bone shrapnel throughout my shoulder socket. And they wanted to do surgery. And I said, yeah, but I've got to leave in 3 days. And they said, for what? And I told them, and they said, well, you need to postpone. I said, I can't postpone. I've got a crew and cast waiting down there. And they said, what? I said, can I do the surgery when I come back? They said, sure, but you're going to really be in a lot of pain. So I made the whole film with my right shoulder just in a lot of pain. And so I honestly don't know how hard the movie would have been without that constant pain, but that was a part of it. I was living on painkillers, living on the edge, getting hit by cyclones and making a really hard movie. But with a lot of great people, an amazing crew, an amazing cast, it's a miracle that nobody died, and it's a miracle that that the movie's complete, and that when people see it in theaters, they don't know how hard it was. Yeah. They just know, wow, that's a fun little movie.
That's great. So what's the message that you hope people will gain from watching this movie, whether they're Latter-day Saints or not, or maybe not even of faith? What do you think they can gain from watching the film?
I think I really, really hope a lot of people of all faiths and of no faith will see the film. It's not a Mormon movie,
right?
For lack of a better expression, it's a movie about Methodists and Catholics and a few Mormons on an island who learn to love and trust each other through a series of heroic and miraculous circumstances. They're forced to face their doubts, their fears, and overcome their mistrust of each other. I mean, you've got think about the movie opens actually with Martin Luther King's "I Have a Dream" speech. Elder Groberg was, living in Idaho Falls, the whitest town in America at the time, probably. When Martin Luther King gave the "I Have a Dream" speech on the National Mall to 200,000 civil rights activists, and at about the same time he received a mission call to go to a kingdom where nobody spoke English, everybody had a different skin color, and most people were not of his faith, and so the kind of the theme of the movie is overcoming those barriers, racial barriers, barriers of creed and color and denomination, to come to be what we really are, which is all God's children, and to love each other without boundaries, without brands. And if you think about it, that's what the first movie was about too. Elder Groberg shows up on this island and he doesn't belong there. He doesn't look like them. He doesn't talk like them. And he learns from them, and they learn to love him because of the sacrifices he makes for them. And in the end, the Methodist minister in the first movie gives his last bit of food to Elder Groberg to save his life after a storm destroys their food source. That movie, it's kind of the same thing, only this time he's got a wife and 5 daughters along for the ride whose lives are also imperiled, and the entire Tongan nation of all denominations rally around the Groberg family and help them through difficult circumstances. And it's just a beautiful adventure and a beautiful uplifting tale. It's true. I love telling true stories. Yeah. It really happened.
That's great. Well, I'm really excited to see it. I get to see it tomorrow, and I'll have I'll figure out some way to do a review here in on Hallmark's podcast. I'll have lots of coverage on my other content, but that will be great. And the last question I just wanted to ask you, was it pretty intimidating casting someone to play President Monson?
Holy cow, was it ever. It was like, how do you do that? But this guy showed up, and I thought it was Thomas S. Monson. I'm like, gosh, where did you come from? His spirit, his demeanor, his jovial personality, and light. He just has a lot of light in him. It was just, the minute he walked in, it was the same thing as casting Chris Gorman. It was like, okay, cancel the rest of our interviews, because this guy's, he's the guy.
Yeah, he's new.
Yeah, and it was a lot of fun. I do want to say one thing. This movie's rated PG-13. I do not want any Hallmarky anywhere on the planet to be scared by that.
Oh, okay, good.
Every time I've shown the movie, there have been 3 and 5-year-olds in the audience, and they have been fine. There's one scene in which a guy gets beaten up by his drunk uncle, and the beat up scene is pretty intense. And so the MPAA, they called us, they said, you know, we know you want a PG rating, and we think this movie is a G to PG movie in all respects, except that one scene when he hits him in the face and, you know, he bleeds from his mouth. We just can't. So it's a completely tame film. Nobody should be afraid to take their kids, or afraid that their spirit is going to somehow be offended. It's just the way the ball bounced, but it's the same kind of movie as the first.
Oh, good. Okay. Well, that's good clarification. Well, congratulations on finishing the film, and thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us. This was really fun.
Rachel, you're a fun person. I cannot wait to see you at the premiere.
Yeah, it's going to be great. Well, do you have any social media that you'd like to share, or for the movie people can?
Everywhere. That's the other thing. This movie is not just going to be in Utah and Arizona. It's going to be released nationwide this Friday, the 28th, on over 200 screens. So go to our website, othersideofheavenmovie.com, /tickets. Or you can also just check locations near you. But we've got theaters all over. We got theaters from Hawaii to Anchorage to Maine and everywhere in between. So we need to fill theaters up opening weekend, or they're going to go away. And I hear people complain in Hawaii, and I feel really bad for them. They say, these movies never come where we are. Well, okay, this one is.
Yeah.
And it's only going to stay where you are. It's only going to stay in Augusta, Maine, or in, you know, Santa Rosa, California, or Omaha, Nebraska, if people show up on opening weekend. They can't say, oh, I'll see it the second or the third or the fourth weekend. There's not going to be a second, third, or fourth weekend unless people show up in mass Friday and Saturday. And if you're a progressive Mormon, Sunday. or Monday night. We got to fill the theaters, or it'll just be like all the others where it shows, you know, opens on 10 screens in Utah and that's it.
So. Yeah. Yeah.
Go. True. Tell everyone, you know,
it's true. Our co-host Amy lives in, the Anaheim region. She said they had she looked it up. It was playing, near her. So. Yeah. It is. It's out there. Definitely check it out. And that'll be great. I'll put all that information people can to the website and all that other stuff in the description section. And I don't know if you're, are you on Twitter or anything like that that you want to share?
Yeah. So othersideofheavenmovie.com, the website, and then Other Side of Heaven Movie on Facebook, and we're on Instagram, and we're on Twitter, but we're not very active on Twitter. Okay. So I just say Facebook, Instagram, and yeah, please spread the word that we got to make this opening weekend happen. Right. It's pretty competitive with other movies that are competing for our little screen. So
yeah, it is definitely so. All right. Well, great. Thank you very much. And we'll look forward to seeing the movie tomorrow. So thanks.
All right. Thank you so much.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.
This podcast was brought to you by Hallmarkies for Hallmarkies. For more information about how you can leave your mark on Hallmarkies, visit hallmarkiespodcast.com, link in the description.